I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for April 3, 2009. I will open a public hearing on SCR 7. Senator Monroe, would you like to come forward? Please identify yourself for the record, although you're known to all of us. Yes, a brief description from the committee administrator.
Yes, SCR 7 congratulates the author William Paul Young of Happy Valley for his success as the author of the best-selling book, The Shack.
Senator Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. SCR 7, I'm Rod Monroe, District 24, Happy Valley and East Portland. Paul Young, wrote a little book called The Shack that has stirred up a lot of interest and attention all over the world. It's been published in 23 languages. Currently, they've sold over 6 million copies for 35 weeks in a row. It's been the number one bestseller. I'm almost finished with reading it, and it is one of the most interesting, exciting, thought-provoking books I've ever read. But the reason for this concurrent resolution is because of the benefits to our state by Mr. Young having written this book, which the story is set in Oregon, Multnomah Falls, Columbia River Gorge, Wallawa Lake, the Wallawa Mountains, and so on. And it has stirred up a lot of attention for the state of Oregon, a lot of tourism, and a lot of excitement across the world, attracting travelers to our state with a significant economic benefit. The other thing that you need to know is we just learned that The Shack is going to be a movie. And as I read it, I thought, man, they got to make a movie out of this story. It's just that kind of a compelling story. And so they are making a movie out of it. They've even got some of the actors picked, I guess. And hopefully the movie will be set on location. I mean, there's no place else they could set it. It's got to be in Oregon, right? And it'll bring economic benefits to our state as well. Mr. Young is tentatively scheduled to join us on the 14th, on April 14th, so I would hope that your committee can expedite this measure so that we can time it so that this very busy man can hear concurrent resolution passed on the Senate floor on April the 14th. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Any questions for Senator Monroe? Seeing none, thank you very much.
And thank you, and I'm off to Ways and Means.
Mr. Luca?
Thank you, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca from Staten, Oregon. And first, let me thank you for hearing this resolution. I know that in these troubled times, there's many pressing needs and critical issues that this committee will be charged with hearing, and in that understanding, I'll be brief. But I wanted to offer you a few points about this work, The Shack, and why I believed it to be worth legislative recognition. In short, The Shack is the story of Mac, a nondescript salesman from the Gresham area, who loses his young daughter to an abduction and murder while on a camping trip to the Wallawa Mountains.
You're giving it away.
It's all in the back of the book jacket. Approximately 4 years later, he gets a letter in his mailbox purporting to be from God, asking him to return to the shack where his daughter's abuse and murder took place. He decides to go and there has an encounter with God that changes him forever and helps in the healing process from the great sadness that had enveloped his life. I don't want to spoil the story, so I'll stop there. I want to make sure I get Senator Atkinson's vote. Suffice it to say that the crime described and the shack itself are metaphors for that great sadness that descends on the lives of so many people and the way that we internalize the pain and continue stumbling forward. You see it in the lives of people who come to this building, parents of murdered children, victims of sexual abuse, people seemingly cast aside by circumstance whose lives are in such an internal turmoil that they wonder if life is some kind of cruel joke that God or the universe or whoever has chosen to play on them. When I picked up this book, it was at the suggestion of a friend who was reading it at the time, and I'd recently gotten my feet under me after my own great sadness. Initially, I read the book out of curiosity about its Oregon backdrop and to share the experience with my friend who lives out of state. And through the pages of the book, however, I found that I related to the pain of the main character, and through his experience I learned much and took a great deal of comfort from the message of the book. And through it I was reminded that whatever the root of pain is in our lives, there's healing and redemption available. Not long afterwards, I was in Ohio for a wedding. This was last year, and I was in a bookstore. I was discussing the book with the bride's father when an elderly woman, overhearing my conversation in Lima, Ohio, began to recall how the book had helped her. Then when I went to the counter, the clerk saw from my driver's license that I was from Oregon and asked if I had read The Shack. She and the other clerks related how meaningful the book was to them, and then wanted to know about the places in the book, asked me if I'd been to Multnomah Falls, if it was a real place, and asked me a number of questions about Oregon. And that's when I realized that this little paperback that had helped me had drawn my friend and I closer together in conversations about the book, and had assisted in my personal journey out of some difficult circumstances, was having an impact very far beyond our region. I had a chance to meet with the author to get some background for this resolution. My friend was in town, and we met Paul at an Oregon City Starbucks. He's a warm, humble, and personable man who greets strangers with hugs instead of handshakes. And when he wrote this book, Paul was working in a Milwaukee warehouse doing inside sales of soldering tips and janitorial work. He wrote this book for his kids, never intending it to see the light of day, but rather presenting in a fictional tale the very real lessons he learned through the hardships of his own life. His story includes sexual abuse, financial ruin, foreclosure, adultery, and more. The first 15 copies of The Shack were run off and bound at a Kinko's in Gresham and given as gifts to his kids and a few family friends, never intended to be published. Those few handed it to a few more and so on. Eventually, Paul and some friends made the decision to publish it and had to self-publish The Shack because nobody else would. Today, though, after debuting at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, the book has maintained that spot for 44 consecutive weeks. Paul told me that he heard from people in Wallowa County who have seen people walking the streets of Joseph holding the book and asking the locals about the places mentioned in it. It sparked an interest in our state that's global in its reach, as the book has been translated into many languages and is being distributed worldwide. My own experience in Ohio and other places since has confirmed this. So I asked him for a few of the stories people had shared with him about how the book had affected their lives. I'll share one before I close. The one story was about a father here in Oak Grove who had been estranged from his son for over 20 years. After his son read The Shack, he called his father from the Midwest and said he was coming to see him. He put the book in his backpack and rode on his motorcycle from the Midwest all the way to Milwaukee, Oregon, and reconciled with his father. There are scores of similar stories of personal and interpersonal healing on the online forum for the book, and I'd encourage everyone to go and read them. You can find the link at theshackbook.com/discuss. Finally, Paul told the Oregonian that the setting of the book was a sort of thank you to Oregon, the place where he had raised his kids. It's my view that Oregon can thank him back with the action that you take today if you would refer this resolution to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Let me just do it this way. I will close public hearing on SCR 7. I will open a work session on SCR 7. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move SCR 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, SCR 7 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection to the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While a certifiable book nerd, and my mother ordered me to read this when I was in recovery last summer, I will be voting no today unless I get my book signed when the author is here on the 14th. I then will change to be a yes vote. If I don't get my book signed from my library, I will remain a no vote.
Is that a courtesy no vote to become a yes vote?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's still a no.
Okay. Motion passes. Senator Monroe will carry. If there are no objections, we will try to expedite this bill to the floor so that when it comes to the floor, I will just set it over to the 14th. So we'll be sure to have it in time. Okay, I will open a public hearing on SB 625. Senator George. Yes.
Senate Bill 625 establishes February 9th of each year as Ewing Young Day.
Senator George, would you please identify yourself for the record as begin at your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Larry George, state senator for Senate District 13, which is Clackamas, Washington, Marion, and Yamhill counties, and a proud alumnus of Ewing Young Elementary School, the home of the Fighting Pioneers. I added the fighting, but nonetheless, I was a proud member of Ewing Young Elementary School, which is about a mile from my parents' house. And so when the Shampooey Historical Community asked me to co-sponsor this bill, I was very proud to do so. I will tell you that I don't think people really recognize the importance that Ewing Young played in the history of the state of Oregon. So I have a few comments, which I think we've submitted in writing. But as I said, I attended Ewing Young Elementary School, and in this school I learned that Ewing Young was not only the first settler in the Chehalem Valley, settling near a place where Chehalem Creek enters the Willamette across from Shampooey. That was the gathering space for many Oregon trappers and settlers. But he also played a very key role in the settlement and establishment of the government of the state of Oregon. He was a colorful trapper and trader and realized possibilities in this new and rich land. As a youth, he left Tennessee and traveled to New Mexico, but he made his way to the state of Oregon, and his spirit of independence and self-sufficiency played a key role in breaking the British Hudson Bay Company monopoly on beaver economics in early Oregon. He built sawmills and ranches, established a trading center, and yes, built Oregon's first still, which is very key in the state. By 1841, Ewing Young was the richest man in early Oregon when he died on February 9th without a will or an heir. And he died in a house that's still standing that's about 1 mile from my parents' house. Because as he extended credit to many of the settlers to give them a start, collecting these debts and distributing the proceeds of his estate was not an easy task. And this is where it is so key, the role that he played. Because he was the richest man, and he had this huge estate, and he had no heirs, Oregon did not have a government then, and there was no system of probate. The day after his funeral, the neighboring settlers met to decide how to best distribute his estate. This led to the Wolf meetings and the famous divide of May 2, 1843, where the provisional government and the first American-style self-government on the West Coast was formed. He was a huge man, a great inspiration for young Oregonians who have read his story to understand the impact that this man had on the state of Oregon is profound. I will tell you that when I moved to Oregon and I started attending Ewing Young Elementary School, my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Zersky, who couldn't be here today but will be here when if this bill gets to the floor, he assigned me the job of writing a story for the Ewing Young School newspaper about Ewing Young, and I marched out to a tree that stands about a mile and a half from the school, the oak tree, and that is the site of where Ewing Young is buried. There is a plaque on the side of this tree that was placed there by the Historical Society of Oregon in 1939, marking that site as the site of the burial spot of Ewing Young. That plaque was, in a number of years later, was stolen and was thought lost forever. And the family that now lives there has just recently told us that somebody came back and dropped that plaque back in their yard just recently. And so the plaque is now back in place on the tree in the Chehalem Valley. So I urge the committee to support Senate Bill 625. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator George. Representative Thatcher, and then we'll go to questions.
Yeah. Hi, thanks. I'm Representative Thatcher from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And in this case, this is essentially about the founder of Newburgh, even though it wasn't Newburgh at the time, obviously. Good senator hit on many of the parts I was going to talk about, but I just want to mention one story of him taking cattle over the Siskiyous. There weren't any roads, and so we made it back to Newburgh with like 600 or so, the 800 or so cattle that he left with, which was pretty amazing feat back then. And he was truly a stories from his life are kind of a, you can picture a Western movie being made out of them. Just wanted to say that preserving Oregon's heritage has always been a very important priority for my district, our district, and in 2007 we passed a resolution in support of Robert Newell, and I am in full support and hope that you can support making February 9th Ewing Young Day in Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Any questions for Senator George or Representative Thatcher? Thank you both for coming here today. Mr. Leo, did you wish to address us also?
Mr. Chairman, could Principal Purcell from Ewing Young School come with me up here?
Yes, that would be fine.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Greg Leo, members of the committee. My name is Greg Leo. I'm president of Friends of Historic Shampooey is my fun job, and we're a support group that supports the historical mission of the Shampooey State Heritage Area. Ewing Young is a great, colorful character who tells the story of early Oregon in a very poignant way. We like to try to tell the Oregon story through a bill every session. As you remember, the Doc Newell bill last session told about Shampooey and the early history. This is really a good opportunity to teach Oregon school kids about Oregon history. Principal Purcell is here today to talk about the elementary school and to talk about how this might work.
Chairman Devlin and members of the Senate Rules Committee, on behalf of the faculty and students of Ewing Young Elementary School in Newburgh.
Excuse me. Could you speak your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Kevin Purcell, principal of Ewing Young Elementary School in Newburgh, Oregon. Sorry. On behalf of the faculty and students of Ewing Young Elementary School in Newburgh, I'd like to express my support for Senate Bill 625, the measure making February 9th Ewing Young Day in Oregon. It's especially appropriate that this bill is brought forward by one of our former students, Senator Larry George, with the co-sponsorship of our state representative, Kim Thatcher. And as you might suspect, Senator George was a good student at Ewing Young Elementary School. I was going to say excellent, but then they said I would have to do 20 more copies. So, but the teachers, Mr. Zersky, and I'm sorry he wasn't here today, said that he was an excellent student. Senate Bill 625 honors the accomplishments of Ewing Young, a pioneer and entrepreneur who, through his passing on February 9, 1841, brought focus for the need for laws and an organization which moved Oregon one step closer to statehood, which was, of course, eventually achieved on February 14, 1859, 18 years later. From an educator's point of view, celebrating February 9th, just 5 days before the anniversary of Oregon statehood each year on February 14th, gives us the opportunity to teach students about early Oregon history, settlement, heritage, and the foundation of the government in an appropriate-sized teaching unit. With these two dates, we can teach the stories of settlement and the early development of Oregon's government. Ewing Young is known as the founding father of Newburgh. He built the first mill and established the first trading post, both of which helped the settlers to become independent from the Hudson's Bay Trading Company in Oregon City. And bringing, as Ms. Representative Thatcher said, bringing the first cattle from California to the valley brought him stature in the community as well. This life serves as a good teaching moment for our students and the adults in our community alike. Early Oregon was built of enterprise, independence, and hard work, qualities which are important to teach our students today. When Ewing Young died on February 9, 1841, he was buried 3.4 miles northwest of Newburgh, as was the tradition at the time. An acorn was pressed into the fresh earth of his grave, where now a beautiful oak tree grows. And I included for you a copy of that, which actually is from this quarterly of the Oregon Historical Society from September of 1920. It was in the front page of that. To tell the story and to see the tree brings alive the history of Oregon. Celebrating February 9th each year will help Oregon's help the school children in the future better understand our past, which will better prepare them for our future. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard in support of Senate Bill 625.
Thank you, Mr. Purcell. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, you asked a question when I spoke with you earlier about the bill about what happened to the proceeds of the probate, and the Oregon Historical Society quarterly actually says that. Some of the money was taken to build a jail in Oregon City. Some of it was kept by the state of Oregon. All
still have that jail, by the way. I'm not.
It could well be.
Some of the same prisoners are still there.
Okay. A heir did show up about 8 or 10 years later from Taos, New Mexico, where Ewing Young had lived, and claimed about $5,000 of the remainder. But all of the archives of the state of Oregon, have the probate materials, and they have been printed in this 1920 version of the Historical Quarterly.
Okay.
It's an interesting story about how Oregon was founded, and we hope by telling the story it inspires, you know, Oregonians to know more about their history. And we would ask respectfully for a do pass recommendation for SB 625.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Leo.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions for Mr. Leo or Mr. Purcell?
Just one. Yeah. Mr. Purcell, you made a claim about the Senator George being a good student. You know, that hasn't actually been documented. And if you could maybe provide the committee with a transcript of his, so we can make that judgment, that would probably be more appropriate.
Report cards?
Yeah.
I'll see what I can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my comment as well. As long as you're talking about archives, surely those report cards must be somewhere in the archives.
Obviously. Ms. Purcell, obviously this is not an official request, but a grade school photo would do.
There are some publications that might use it.
I will see what I can do.
Okay. Thank you both very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on SB 625. I will open a work session on SB 625. We do have a fiscal and revenue statement, no impact. In either case, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 625 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved to move Senate Bill 625 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing no objections to the motion passes. Senator George, would you like to carry? Thank you very much. I will now open a public hearing on SCR 8. And Senator Ferrioli, would you like to address, well, first the committee administrator will go through a brief overview, and then Senator Ferrioli, would you like to give a brief presentation?
SCR 8 memorializes the late Mark Ted Winters, who passed in the year 2008.
Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is State Senator Ted Ferrioli, District 30. And if you don't mind, I'll just testify from here, if that's possible.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
And by brief, I just meant that we're trying to keep this quiet.
Brief as brief is as brief does, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman. I think most folks are familiar with the contributions of Ted Winters. He was had an incredible story of his life is retold in a book that he has written. He actually published two books, Never Kill Lions and Lifer. I highly recommend those two books to anybody within the sound of my voice. Extraordinary stories of redemption and survival from a youth misspent and a brush with the criminal justice system that put him into the institution for life. His transformation in that system is really an incredible story. He went from an inmate, essentially, to a founder of an institute, the New Life Christian Network, a post-prison ministry. He served honorably in administration for a couple of governors, essentially earned a full pardon eventually, also in effect worked all of his life in public service. He passed away recently. We held a memorial service within the Capitol building. It was attended by hundreds of people, literally. It's just an extraordinary story, and we felt that Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 in memoriam of Ted Winters is a fully appropriate action for this body to take. We also would point out that in recognition of the incredible transformation and the service that Ted Winters rendered to the state, that we would be planting a tree on the Capitol campus that would memorialize his service to the state. And that's the sum total of Senate Concurrent Resolution 8, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Atkinson.
Senator Ferrioli, has there been any discussion as to what type of tree?
I think the meetings were held and a tree variety has been selected along with the location and provisions for maintenance of the tree after it's planted. But I disremember the varietal nature of that memorial tree.
Just so the people in the room understand why I'm saying brief is this is an unusual thing. We are trying to keep this not too much attention right now because we're trying to surprise Senator Winters. So I'm holding a public hearing on something we're trying to surprise Senator Winters on. And obviously she is one of our most respected colleagues, and her late husband was very well respected in this building. Is there any additional discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you need to go to the next step and swear everyone in this audience and everyone watching this to silence.
Any additional discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Motion passes. Senator Farrioli, would you like to carry, or is there someone you would like to designate?
Mr. Chair, I think it should be carried by members from both sides of the aisle, so I would co-carry.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I
yes.
would volunteer to co-carry.
Okay.
If you're looking if for volunteer.
Okay, Senator Farrioli and Senator Burdick will be co-carriers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to move on very quickly to do our last action item and then come back to our work sessions. I'm going to open a work session on SB 378. Can the committee administrator give a brief overview and then talk briefly about the amendment? As the committee members might remember, we were going into work session on this, and the long-term care ombudsman came in and requested a minor amendment. Not minor in their mind, but minor in terms of how it would modify the bill.
Yes, Senate Bill 378, as written, restricts the Senate confirmation for the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee only to those members appointed by the governor. And as Chair Devlin mentioned during testimony, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman recommended an amendment to clarify that members appointed to the committee may not have any financial interest or other involvement with long-term care facilities. Ledge Council has drafted that amendment in your packet. It's the -1 amendments.
Okay.
And we have a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the original bill and the amendment.
Okay. Is there a motion on the -1 amendment?
I move the -1 amendments, Mr. To Senate Bill 378.
Okay, the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 378 have been moved. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Is there a motion to forward the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 378 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved to send Senate Bill 378 to the floor with due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, motion passes. Senator Metzger, will you carry, and should you be on the dais, I will back.
Okay.
Members of the committee, I am going to take about a 2-minute recess in which to get Senator, I'm going to give them longer than that. That's not fair. About a 5-minute recess to get Representative Galizio and Senator Morse here to testify on the next two bills.
Okay. Do you know Senator Morse in the meeting?
Senator Metzger is not here, but I think he'll be back momentarily. Okay. I will reconvene the Senate Committee on Rules for April 3rd, 2009, and I will open public hearing simultaneously on both SB 656 and SJR 11. Senator Morse and Representative Galizia, would you please come forward? And then I will take more testimony from the public. Senator Morse, would you like to begin? Oh, yes. Can the committee administrator give a brief description of both bills?
Yes, Senate Bill 656 will require the Secretary of State to include a fiscal impact statement in the ballot title of certain initiated state measures. The phrase would appear in the voter's pamphlet and on the ballot as part of the caption of the ballot title. SJR 11 creates a so-called indirect initiative process whereby once an initiative qualifies for the ballot, it is first submitted to the next regular session of the legislature for an advisory vote. And then the Secretary of State will put it on the next general election ballot along with the results of the advisory vote and any legislative findings. You have testimony and proposed amendments coming around from the members, and you also have a couple of PowerPoints with some background that was provided by the Oregon Business Alliance.
Okay. Senator Morse, would you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator representing District 8, Albany, Corrales areas. Thank you for scheduling both of these bills for a hearing. I will direct my comments, initial comments, specifically to SJR 11, and my colleague, Representative Galizia, will open on Senate Bill 56. You had just a very brief description of what the bill, of what SJR 11 does, but what it is it's an attempt to reform the initiative process to create a more informed and thoughtful process to evaluate a proposed measure, not to deny access, but to better inform the electorate. And I would say at the outset that I have great confidence in the voters. This is not an attempt to derail access to the initiative process. It's an attempt to create a more informed electorate. And let me run through why I think that that will happen. what the bill would require, and by the way, as we know, this is a resolution referring this decision ultimately to the voters, not for us to make, but for the voters to make. That would require the legislature to consider the initiative without change or amendment before the end of the session. And each chamber would hold hearings, make legislative findings, and conduct an advisory vote. And then the Secretary of State would make those legislative findings available in the bill as a manner provided by law, which would be the voter's pamphlet. And the legislature would have several options. One would be to refer an alternative, and that we have done in Measure 57. One would be to take no further action, or to enact an alternative measure. The chief petitioner in that event would have the opportunity to withdraw 35 days following sine die the initiative. So it would actually... Colleagues, contrary to, I believe, the opposition to this measure, it would strengthen the initiative process because it would give those petitioners a platform within this body to hold hearings, find intended consequences, and work through the legislative process to possibly craft a better alternative that could be referred to the voters. And I would suggest that you think about Measure 37, 47, and 49 and the history of that initiative process. There were fatal flaws within that bill as it was referred to the voters and passed out. Came back here, and ultimately the petitioners not only failed, they failed badly. So it would give an opportunity to take a measure that is not crafted appropriately but has broad support and put it in a way that achieves its intended consequence. In the event the legislature refers an alternative, it must be identified as an alternative to the initiative, and the voter then has two choices. The first choice is to choose between either ballot or neither ballot, and if the majority of votes is neither, then the initiative fails. So you would have alternative A, alternative B, and neither. If A or B receives a majority vote, then it goes to the second choice. If C is selected, neither, then the initiative fails. So the second choice would then, one of the two receives a majority, then it would drop down to the second choice, which would be only A and B, and the measure that received the majority vote would in fact become law. And that was a problem with the choice between measure 57 and 61. It didn't provide that other alternative, which is neither. Then if SJR 11 becomes effective, if enacted, it would become effective 4 months before the regular session in 2012, which would accommodate any of the initiatives in process that would be potentially derailed if we enacted it at an earlier date. The primary negative to SJR 11 is that bringing initiatives to the ballot will take longer. I would suggest to you that, and it puts it essentially in a two-year cycle, that we have historically operated in a two-year cycle. And there are many issues that come up in one biennium and do not find success until a future biennium. This process should be thoughtful and it should be thorough. And so I would suggest that the length of time by which we enact laws is not particularly a negative, and I will address that when I address the why. There is virtually no disagreement that initiatives have had a significant and profound impact on the fiscal affairs of our state. These are very, very weighty decisions that appear before voters via the initiative process. If you look back on history, I think it's illustrative of why these issues are of such grave importance, actually. In 2005 and 2007, 27% of discretionary spending was set by voters. Between 1989, 91, and 2005 and 2007, discretionary spending increased $7 billion, with voters' initiatives representing $3.4 billion of that amount. Nearly 50% of the increase in spending was directly driven through the initiative process. And then if you look at spending on an inflation-adjusted basis per person, before the impact of initiatives in 1989-91, and that period was really the wave, the 90s was the wave of initiatives in Oregon, spending was $1,625 per person. And then if you come forward in 2005-07, spending was $1,583 per person, again, on an inflation-adjusted basis. So you can see where the impact of initiatives have fallen. How do they affect K through 12 funding? Again, inflation adjusted, 1992-93, which was when Measure 5 began to be normalized. The weighted student spending was $6,176. In the 5-6 year, it was $5,512. A reduction, actual reduction, on a per student basis, inflation adjusted. The effect on higher education was even more profound. And if you take from 1991 to 2007, the state support for higher education declined 36% per student, which resulted in students making up the difference in tuition and fees. That's one of the principal reasons why Oregon is a high-fee state compared to other states, is we have shifted to students the cost, a greater share of the cost of education. State support has declined to where we're now 44 out of 50 in our state support for higher education. Well, initiatives have placed great stress on the ability to fund critical services. And those things that were in play in 1990 did not go away. They're still present, but we've added additional responsibilities to our discretionary source of funds. I believe SJR provides an opportunity to shine a bright light on intended and unintended consequences, utilizing the full resources of the legislature, which are our council, revenue, and legislative fiscal offices, to analyze the measure. It provides an opportunity for the media to report on the initiative, which informs voters. It provides legislators an opportunity to inform their constituents through newsletters, town halls, and mailings. It provides the petitioner a platform to make the case for the measure and the opponents an equal platform to make a case against the measure. When an initiative has been approved for the ballot by the Secretary of State, considerable leverage is afforded the petitioner to work with the legislature, the legislative process, to craft a better measure with the alternative to either enact the improved measure or to refer the voters the improved measure and withdraw the original measure. And SJR 11 provides that. Colleagues, the legislature should not diminish access to the initiative process. It should seek to make it better. And I believe SJR 11, in fact, does that. So, Mr. Chair, colleagues, I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony on SJR 11, and I'll defer to my colleague.
Representative Galizio, before I go to you, I just wanted to put on the record, Senator Morse, you have a companion HJR on this bill, correct?
Yes. In fact, we have both bills that we're hearing today have companion measures in the House.
Yeah. And I have had this discussion with you, but I haven't had the chance to discuss it with Representative Galizio and Representative Esquivel. A lot of the initiative reform measures are starting on the House side. One of the reasons I'm holding this hearing here today is should that bill in one case, come here, I'd like this committee to start to discuss these issues because we're going to be, once those measures, should they come here, that's going to be one of the major tasks of this committee is dealing with initiative reform-related issues. We will have one major bill, I believe, that's coming over here relatively soon also on initiative reform. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, thank you for the opportunity. Before I talk about the other bill, the number of which I'm forgetting, I just wanted to comment a little bit more.
Bill 656.
Yeah, before I get to that, I just wanted to make a couple more comments on the indirect or SJR 11, if I might. You know, Woodrow Wilson called the initiative process the gun behind the door. In other words, if the legislature fails to act or acts in a way that majority of or a requisite number of signatures finds is problematic, the initiative process provides a vehicle to either force us to act or make changes. And that's something that I think both of us want to keep. And I would argue that the indirect initiative is actually, and my senator, Senator Burdick, might not like this analogy at all, but I would call this the gun in the Capitol bill. And here's why. In the status quo, if there's an initiative that qualifies, gets the requisite number of signatures, yet fails at the ballot, none of us have to talk about it. In the indirect initiative, you get the requisite number of signatures, we have to talk about it in this building. And I think that empowers the public in a way that does not exist in the status quo. It's quite frankly why some of our colleagues are a little bit uncomfortable with it. But I think having that extra burden and accountability for us is something that's a good thing. And at the same time, it asks initiative petitioners to have a bit of a delay. And I think you're going to hear testimony from Dan Meek and others that the delay is unacceptable, and that's this is the policymaking decision that we're going to have to make. I think a key point of the indirect initiative is hearings are useful. Is something constitutional? you can contextualize the conversation. The deliberative discussion that we have, you could ask the chief petitioner, and proponents and opponents can have a discussion, difficult questions posed back and forth. Okay, well, how are you going to fund it? Or do you know that this is going to affect? And issues can be raised. So that's another, it errs on the side of a more deliberative discussion as opposed to sort of clamping down on the initiative process. It says, all right, you got enough signatures, let's have a discussion. So that's the sort of the undergirding values that support it. It's no mistake that the chief petitioners in this case, it's a bicameral, bipartisan. I have found people on that side of this building, in my caucus, and groups that are supportive of a bulk of what I do and others do that don't really like it. At the same time, I think Senator Morse has found that there are people that typically support his perspective that don't like it either, and sometimes that means it's a good thing. So I talked to my neighbor. My neighbor is the focus group for a lot of bills, and I asked him, I said, what do you think about this? And he said, well, I need to get more information, but you should refer it to us so that we can make a decision. I said, that's a great idea. So I'll stop talking about that, and you've opened okay. So on the other...
Mr. Chair, could I just interrupt for half a second? I have to leave this meeting, but I didn't want to because of another commitment, but I didn't want to leave without thanking the sponsors of these initiatives for bringing them forward. Senate Bill 656 is actually the result of a recommendation from the Tax Restructuring Committee. And the indirect initiative, I think, is really critical. I actually was a chief petitioner on an initiative, and I did kind of the indirect initiative backwards because my initiative requiring background checks at gun shows was the product of a full legislative session of discussion. Bills passed the House, and a bill passed the Senate. And the initiative itself was the product of both of those highly debated, highly deliberated processes. And this initiative has never been challenged in court. It's working well. And so it was actually a product of a process that you are talking about here. I think it's very constructive, and I just wanted to put those comments on the record before I have to leave, and I do apologize.
Thank you, Senator Burr. Please proceed.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Burr, thank you for that. Yeah, but, I mean, Measure 37 was an outcry saying, legislature, in terms of land use, we don't like what you're doing. You need to make a change. And unfortunately, the measure, because of the way it was written, it was arguably poorly crafted. It was the Land Use Attorney Full Employment Act, whereas if you, with the indirect, would have forced us to have a conversation, maybe something better would have come out of that. So, Senate Bill 656 is ballot title change. All the research shows, and you can talk to people on the left or on the right, consultants on the left or on the right, the ballot title is what is the most significant thing in terms of initiatives and whether or not you get votes. That's why focus groups are convened on both sides of the political spectrum looking at the ballot title. So what this Senate Bill 656 would do is create a flashing yellow warning signal saying, hey, take a look at whether or not there is some type of plan in the measure to either provide funding or whether there is no funding mechanism. It attempts to contextualize the measure a little bit. We had testimony on this in the House side, and Dan Meek, I thought, brought up some excellent points, and so I think I'm speaking for both of us. We're amenable to making some changes because, again, the ballot title, the language, you don't have that much room. So we're trying to simplify it, but this would basically say the measure does not provide a plan for funding, or alternatively, has provided a plan for partial funding, or alternatively, has provided a plan for funding, or measure has no fiscal impact. And I think you're going to hear testimony that says that leaves out some other more complex differences that are important, and so we're amenable to changing the language perhaps, but it's just taking into effect the fact that most people just look at the ballot title and make their decision. So it would be a warning light, and it would just hopefully trigger people to look further into the initiative. You know, what is that partial funding, and what does it do? Okay.
Representative Esquivel, and then we'll go to questions, and then to our next group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. I'm here 4656. If I had my druthers, I would rather have it to where we could put a specific amount of money and where it came from what department and what part of this building that money comes from for any initiative. But we can't do that. But at least this does give what we call the warning light. And it's kind of like, beware, there may be hidden consequences. Or we ask the question, what if or what now? And that's why I'm so supportive of 656, because it does, in fact, put people on point that there may be some hidden implications in this initiative process and what you're about to vote on. So I fully support it. I've been supportive with Senator Morris, and I have been very supportive of restructuring in the state of Oregon, and we shall continue to do so, but we need to make it more educate the people that mark the ballot more so, and we need to continue on to educate them so they, as well as the rest of us, can understand exactly what they're doing. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I have two questions, actually, and be for any of you. Although we are not in work session, we're in public hearing. 656 is your amendment. 656-1 is your amendment to 656, and the dash threes are probably your latest amendment to the SJR. Is that correct?
That's correct, okay. Mr. Chair.
Just for the record. Questions for the panelists. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You didn't even say yes. I could see it in your eyes.
I just nodded in the affirmative, Mr. Chair. Is there, and this is for the two panelists that are in support of SJR 11, is there presently anything which prevents the legislature from taking up any issue that's subject to an initiative?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I think we have latitude to take up any issue.
That would be a no.
Yeah, I don't think there's any.
So currently there is no prohibition from the legislature at any legislative session picking up any issue that is the subject of an initiative petition, whether approved or not approved, approved or opposed, proposed.
No, that's correct, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli. But I would suggest to you that the divisions within this building dictate what is heard and what is not heard.
Oh, excellent point. So, following along, Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
You just basically characterized that the partisan nature of this building might affect the outcome of the legislative votes on those legislative considerations of petitions. So how do you keep the partisan process and the influence of special interests from dictating the outcome of the legislative consideration of an initiative petition?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I put great faith in the people that serve us, Legislative Council. I believe they're objective. I believe they try to craft language that is consistent with law and the Constitution. I believe legislative revenue is objective when they evaluate something and they say it has a revenue impact. I believe legislative fiscal is objective, and I think those resources coming to bear that otherwise would not come to bear if you just get the signatures, qualify, and run to the ballot. This process, as we know, is a political process. But at least you have the platform and an opportunity to talk about the intended and the unintended, hold hearings, consequences, hold hearings, and then for us to take advisory votes. I believe, and some of our colleagues would choose not to do that, I believe that the constituents we represent deserve to know how I would vote or support an initiative.
Follow?
Yes.
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that legislative fiscal, legislative council, or legislative revenue are biased. What I meant to point out is that we have a partisan process here. Chair people decide what gets heard and who to invite for testimony. We see that every day here. There's an interesting anomaly here. in our chamber, and perhaps the rules are different in the House, we're not even permitted to refer to an action taken by the House or refer to the number of votes cast for a particular measure. And I believe the reason that we are prohibited in our rules from referring to the actions of another chamber is to prevent undue influence on the thinking or the votes cast by the members. How is this not seeking to affect the outcome of initiatives?
Well, Mr. Chair, the intent of this measure is to provide a greater degree of information than what is presently provided. If you think about the process today, once it's qualified and it goes to the ballot, what do you have? What level of information do you have? You have, obviously, the voter's family. You have those for, those against. You have your fiscal committee that makes that determination. But it immediately falls into that 30-second soundbite. And what this, I believe, would do is provide voters a more informed base by virtue of the process we go through here. You wouldn't have the chair's decision to not hold a hearing. It would be required. You would hold hearings, and you would have an opportunity for people pro and against. It just opens it up. It has greater information than what you presently have today, and that's the intent, is to create a more informed electorate so that those decisions are more thoughtful. That's why I'm bringing this bill forward, and with my colleague and the support of Representative Esquivel as well.
Okay. Representative Galizio.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriola, I think these are great questions. I would like to respond. I mean, on the first question, what prevents us in the status quo from taking up something that we hear? I would say legally nothing, but political, as you know, political calculations and sometimes cowardice is what prevents us from doing it. And what I like about this is it would force us to confront these issues head on. To your second point, which I think is also an important point about the partisanship and sort of gamesmanship that occurs, that will not go away. That will never go away. And this resolution in no way, shape, or form thinks that it will go away. However, as Senator Moore said, number one, it says absolutely the presiding officers will send it to committees. You hope that then the media focus on the hearings and the different interest groups can raise their concerns, but an advisory vote is only that. The bottom line is, at the end of the day, the chief petitioner can still say, I don't like, you know, if no agreement is reached, they can just take it to the ballot and say, hey, the people are going to decide. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Follow-on question. Is there anything that would prevent a legislator from getting fiscal analysis on a proposed initiative and publishing that in the voter's pamphlet?
Mr. Chair, Senator, in the status quo?
Yeah, under current law?
No.
Okay. So the information that this would produce in terms of better analysis is currently available. The legislature is not prevented from taking any of these issues up. The only thing lacking would be the forced advisory vote.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriola, each of us individually could insert 90 statements. Do we do that? No. Very seldom does that happen. This essentially creates a very brighter light on an initiative that voters will be voting on, and that's what it does.
We're to the place, Mr. Chairman, where people who disagree will explain more slowly and more distinctly what the measure does. I understand what the measure is intended to do. What I'm trying to point out is that everything that you've offered here, the idea that a deeper analysis would be possible, is currently available. Because if I see an initiative petition and I wonder about the outcome, I can submit it to legislative fiscal and publish the results. if I wish to take a position pro or con, I can buy a page in the voter's pamphlet and make my views known. The only thing different is an advisory vote that's forced, and I would suggest that that is an attempt to influence the outcome of the initiative. And we have mechanisms to do that. I also question the assumption that that all the money that we're currently spending on initiative measures that were passed or adopted by the electorate would accrue to K-12 or higher ed or any other particular issue. I guess that assumption, you know, there'd be more money available, more resources available, ergo we'd spend them in, you know, in the current priorities. I don't know if I support that assumption. It's interesting. I really appreciate the additional verbiage that Senate Bill 656 would insert into the procedures, but in terms of SJR 11, I'm sorry, I regard it as meddling in what is an institution specifically reserved for the electorate. It is, in fact, and it was intended to be the shotgun behind the door, not manipulated, packaged, sliced, diced, and politically influenced by this legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. A follow-up, not to be argumentative with my good colleague, not
to the right.
Right, but on...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But one of the cases that you didn't present that perhaps you could comment on in terms of the checks and balances on the legislature was the ability of the proponents of the initiative to take their initiative unrevised to the ballot if they did not believe that the legislature had done justice to what they had put forward. If you might want to comment on that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's exactly correct. There's nothing that moves. We would not, by this measure, have the ability to amend that initiative. That moves forward. But I would suggest to Senator Farioli, if you or I were to put a statement in the voter's pamphlet, how much media do you get out of that? None. You get none. If you bring an initiative here and it's deliberated, you'll have front page, you'll have editorials, you'll have letters to the editors. We have just the vehicles available to us to talk about this, pro and con. And you elevate the level of debate on this issue in a way that you don't presently have. So I appreciate where you're coming from. I actually believe that it empowers the minority to a greater degree than the majority. That's my own judgment, Mr. Chair.
To my left, Senator Atkinson.
What a shocking statement that is. A couple things. Forgive me for not having one name and one initiative at the tip of my brain, but in the late 1960s, Tom McCall was Secretary of State. He was opposed to a particular initiative, and the Attorney General was opposed to the same initiative. And it was a rule change that shortened the amount of time the signatures were valid to try to kill this particular ballot measure before it got to the ballot. And that rule, which I've tried to get overturned for years, and contrary to the last statement, nobody's in media has cared. I've got no letters for editors. It's like a historic anomaly, and people think it's, I don't know what, why no one cares. But it shortened the amount of time that signatures were valid. As we saw several years ago, the Secretary of State Bradbury, at the end of one of our very long sessions, drawing the clock down by playing partisan hackery and drew down the amount of time that those signatures were valid to try to discourage a initiative. The opening statement you said, one of you said, SJR 11 will ensure a two-year period. Help me understand that those signatures are going to be valid for 2 years in here, because If that's true, that's a huge victory for something I care strongly about. Where is that in the bill?
Well, do you want to respond?
Go ahead.
If I understand the line of your thought, I believe, and we could ask legislative council, that's probably more appropriate, but once the measure qualifies and the Secretary of State has in fact verified the signatures and it arrives here, that's done.
Go for it.
It's on its way. Is that your...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it seems to me you're talking about if this codifies in law that the element of how much time you have to gather signatures, you'd say that would be a great thing. Is that inaccurate?
Yes, yeah. But I don't see it in the law.
Right. This the change that this would make, it would really make no change in terms of directly the signature gathering process in terms of amount of signatures. It would shift the time a little bit of amount to gather, but I don't know that it would get to what you're talking about, and I agree with Senator Morse in terms of asking ledge counsel about that. But what it would do is, again, if you get the requisite number of signatures, and Oregon, actually, compared to most states, we have a very low bar, as arguably we should. There's plenty of time to gather signatures. So, but I don't know that it gets to exactly what you're saying.
Well, I'd like to see if it does, because I don't think that it does. And if it does, that's great. But right now, if it's a referral out of this building and the people want to have a competing initiative, which happens on occasion, there is the built-in mechanism. If a partisan Secretary of State, not saying that the current one is, but if a partisan wants to be difficult, they can't. They have every way to do it by delaying, which eats into that time frame, which I think is patently wrong. Let me get to the next thing. My next question, Mr. Chair. You kept bringing up, every time you said Measure 37 and Measure 49, I cringed, because before there was a 49 and a 37, and before there was a 7, before 7 ever got here, this body refused to take up compensation for takings. We kicked that around for 2 sessions before Measure 7 came out. And this body, and all of our fiscal analysis and all of the people that went around this building and all of the statewides, and the sky was going to fall and this was going to bankrupt government and yada, 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 yada. I mean, it was so you had one side saying this is the right thing to do, it's a moral thing to do, and it's not going to cost very much, and government shouldn't be taking land anyway. And then on the other side, you had people for about 4 years saying, people ran for office saying that these wing nuts are going to bankrupt the state of Oregon. I mean, it was just so predictably silly before we ever got to Measure 7. So, and you can imagine that the press that generated. So, so it became common knowledge with politicians that it cost too much. We all know if you want to kill something, you put a fiscal on it. But the people spoke another way and went with Measure 7 and then eventually went with Measure 37. How does this measure actually get us to a fiscal that doesn't have the politics on it of trying to kill something before it actually gets out? Measure 7 is my key question there. How do you do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, number one, I would tell you unequivocally, this bill will not eliminate stupidity or bad decisions by humans in this building or outside of it. And I absolutely include myself in that. I haven't figured out a bill that would do that.
Sine die.
I second that motion.
We have that bill.
But I can't speak specifically to the fiscal statement that was put on Measure 7 and the pressure that was perhaps put on legislative fiscal. I think what this bill does, bottom line, is it keeps the status quo that if the chief petitioner gets his signatures and they want to take it to the ballot, it gets to the ballot, and regardless of what we do in this building, it gets to the ballot. So maybe that's the best answer that I can give to your question. There's always going to be partisanship, and people are going to try to game the system. But in the end, the chief petitioner takes that thing to the ballot if they get the requisite number of signatures. And that's one of the reasons I like it.
Yeah. That's fair. Your example of 3749 and then 7, and then me having been here for too long, remembering before 7,
That
was so over the top. I mean, you had people saying that we're going to have to sell the Capitol building in the southern part of the state to California to pay for all these claims. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
This won't change
that. And it was part of the lexicon. I mean, you had the left and you had editorials saying that this is bad, and on the other hand, you had all this uprising of people upset. And
Senator Morris, before I go to you, once we go to you, what I'd like to do, I very much appreciate you three coming here today. I've got a group of people in the audience that have been waiting a relatively long time, and I've only got so much time that I can hold a quorum here. But if you would like to comment, Senator Morris, I very much appreciate that.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a final question for the panel as well.
Okay. Senator Morris, if you'd comment, and we go to a final question, and then we will bring up the other people. So.
Well, just very briefly, we know that polling drives issues. Measure 7 supported. Measure 37 supported. Then it came unwound by virtue of the language of the bill. It did. Virtually was coming unwound. I think that you could bring that. If you'd brought 37 here and gone through the process, given the swing in this state where people are saying land use isn't working well, you could have crafted something, had the petitioner drop it, and then move it forward. It might not have been everything that the petitioner wanted, but it would be a step forward. But I don't want to debate that issue any longer.
Thank Senator you, Ferriol, you had it.
Is this bill, to any of the panelists, is this bill intended to affect the outcome of initiatives?
To affect the outcome, I think the intent from my perspective is to affect the level of knowledge upon which voters will make a decision. That's the ultimate, is the voter decision.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the intent to improve the process. I would just point out to you that we have the big look. We haven't said the last words about Measure 37 and Measure 49. Let me suggest that Measure 37 was subjected to a partisan process in this building. And the result is that claims are high-centered and stuck and derailed. And that's the outcome I would expect from this involvement of the legislature in what is a process that is entirely reserved for the electorate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, if this bill comes back, there will be another opportunity for another public hearing. If the committee administrator would indicate that in the record so that I know that we'll not come back for work session. There will be other opportunities for public hearing should it come back. But I very much appreciate you three coming here today, and we will go to the other people that have come here to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
We have a hearing open both on 656 and SGR 11. I have only one person out of the parties that have asked to testify that is testifying on just one of them. And she's just about in order to come next, so I'm going to take her first, and then I'm going to bring up some panels of people, even though they may have differing positions. Ms. Georgette Brown from the Association of County Clerks, you wanted to speak about 656.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, committee members. I know what the proponents of 656 are saying. I understand that they want to give some more information to the electorate. And the county clerks always want to give more information to the electorate. That's why in my own county, way back when I was the Josephine County Clerk, I started a voter's pamphlet because I wanted to give more information. But this 656, looking at it, there definitely is a possible fiscal for the counties. because the general election, I mean, if you look at the fiscal impact that I handed out, with so many measures on the ballot, there's a possibility that if there's anything added to the actual caption, and it's some of the wording would take two lines, that we could end up again with two ballots. I went through the two ballot thing in November 2000, and it was horrible as far as managing it. Our election boards were confused because they tried to balance the number of envelopes with the ballots that were in them, and typically people don't send back both ballots. A lot of them don't, and so the counts were off. And they started at 7 o'clock in the morning, the boards, and at 4 o'clock the next morning they were still not done. So there's a real possibility of problem, and then what it would cost for two ballots and the postage, as you can see on this. So what I would suggest, since the caption and the question are on the ballot, this fiscal could be put in the summary, which is also part of the question. And the whole question is included in that extra flyer that goes in with the ballot. I'm sure when you get your ballots, you have that other one that has the whole question in it. I mean, several years ago, the law got changed to allow just the question and the caption on the ballot, just because of the length of the ballots that we, and this has continued through the years, that we have lengthy ballots. And so it's just a question of dollars and cents that I'm talking about.
Okay. Any questions from Ms. Brown? Seeing none, thank you for coming today.
Thank you for hearing me. Thank you.
I'm going to bring up two panels. The first panel will be Andy Miller and Miss Eaton. My. Is that happy?
Yes.
Okay. In just a second. You might separate those mics a little bit from one another because they are starting to interact. Okay, Ms. Miller, if you would like to start.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for Oregon Business Association.
And sorry to interrupt, but since both hearings are open, you can comment on both bills.
Thank you, sir. I was intending to do that. First of all, I have prepared comments, which you can read, and you pretty well covered the topic with your questions for Senator Morris and Representative Galizio. I do have a couple thoughts that aren't in the testimony that I wanted to add. One is that we have done polling on the initiative process, and the majority think that the process needs to be improved. And that was a non-specific question, so I noticed earlier you'd said, why can't you just leave it alone? Because most people are unsatisfied. And so what we're trying to do with a number of the measures that we support, both in the House and these two before you today, is to try to improve the process without taking away the rights of citizens to partake in the process. And that's a fine line that we're riding, and that's why we're having these deliberative hearings. The other thing I wanted to comment on was the opportunity to work in a bipartisan, bicameral situation like this with the two folks that were up here has been really a great experience. And we've had organized a coalition called the Initiative Reform Coalition, and it has almost anybody who cares, and it is it's really been a good experience. So those are things I'd like to add. As far as SGR 11 goes, this was very our good government committee like this. This was their favorite thing of all the recommendations that we studied. And they were, I'm going to read this because it's a quote from my chair of that committee. Our goal is to restore integrity to the initiative process so that it is transparent, accessible, and works as it was originally intended while protecting it from potential abuses and harmful unintended consequences. We've already had someone jump on the unintended consequences issue, so I'll pre-up that and say one of the things we're concerned about in our study of this is that the consequences may have been intended by the chief petitioner, but the voters often don't understand what the consequences are, and that's the reason that Senate Bill 656 is of interest to us. I don't know if you are aware, but our bond rating is affected by the initiative process, and that's also a big concern to our members. It has been wreaking havoc with the state budget, and we believe that representative government needs to be respected and protected as well. So other comments are in here, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. We will go to Ms. Eaton first, and then we'll go to questions. Ms. Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Commenting first on SJR 11, and it's already alluded to that there are indeed bills in the House. SJR 17 or HJR 17 is the equivalent of SJR 11, and we've had hearings in the House on that. And the League is a member of this initiative reform coalition, in which we are taking a look at the variety of measures that are before the legislature. And I think what it reflects is that there is great interest both in preserving the initiative as an honored institution for the public to be involved with direct democracy, but also that it needs to be, it has some improvements that can help the integrity and give the transparency to the situation that I think the polling has indicated, as Andy pointed out to you. Voter information about ballot measures is of extreme concern to the League, because we want people to understand how laws are designed, whether they are from the legislature or from the initiative. People need to understand what the purpose of the law is. And we feel and have felt for some time that there needs to be a much better review process of initiatives as they are proposed. And so the indirect initiative got into our positions more than 20 years ago. Our members decided that a deliberative review by the legislature would be a good idea. It is done in a number of other states that have the initiative process to some degree of success, we believe. And we believe that the constitutionalist amendment is necessary, I think, in sort of in answer to your question about Senator Ferrioli about the legislature already having the ability to do this. They probably do, but they won't, or they don't. And so adding to the initiative process the idea that it needs to be vetted, if you will, by the legislature is important. Other states that do this have an initiative process where they vote on them often every year, so it's a little different here. But we still feel this is an important piece to the people understanding what the consequences are, and that brings me to 656, which is putting into the ballot title what the fiscal impact is. Most people look at the ballot title and not a whole lot else, and they make their decisions on the ballot title. So, yes, there might be fiscal impact that's down in the explanatory statement someplace, but they don't necessarily go there. And that's why we support 656 as giving the ability for people to see right up front that this either has a cost or it doesn't have a cost, and they can make the decision about whether they want to vote on the bill on that basis. And we, in talking about that, find that it's very important to people to want to know what something costs. So at this point in time, the League is supporting both 656 and the companion in the House, which is 2845. And we think that, and we hope that both the House and the Senate Rules Committee will get together on these measures, because they're hearing both of them, several of them. This is just two of the examples, because it is important to make sure that the initiative process, which we started in 1902, is reserved for the people, and that we make it as good as we can so that they can have their issues addressed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Eaton, Ms. Miller. Any questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ferriero.
First of all, who is the coalition, the Initiative Reform Coalition?
Senator Devlin, Chair Devlin, Senator Ferrioli, the membership is about 35 or 40 people representing organizations such as AOI, Oregon Nursery Association, League of Women Voters, Oregon Education Association, Oregon Business Association. I'd be happy to send you that distribution list if you'd like to see
it. I'd
that.
Like to have that, Mr. Chair. And the other question I'd like to ask relative to that, Mr. Chairman, do you have petitioners, chief petitioners in the coalition?
I've been a chief petitioner, Senator.
So have I.
Chair Devlin, Senator Ferrioli, Cappy, Ms. Eaton, and I were chief petitioners together at one time, actually. So, yes, we do have chief petitioners in the coalition.
Okay. And this is going to be I hope this is a really tough question that I'm going to ask you both. Is it that people don't like the outcomes of initiatives, or is it that they don't like the process?
Chair Devlin, Senator Ferrioli, that's an excellent question, and I would say, to be honest, it's both. The outcomes, however, we're not trying to manipulate outcomes. We're trying to make sure that people understand the consequences of those outcomes. And I tried my very darndest. I wasn't a political creature until ballot measure 5. I had children in the Lake Oswego schools. And I thought, why in the world would we want to bring everyone in the state down? Why don't we try to bring something that would bring everyone in the state up to the level of Lake Oswego? And that is your fortunate day that I got involved in politics. And I said to my husband, this is going to be a disaster. He said, oh, you're overreacting. For heaven's sakes, the world hasn't collapsed. And every 2 years, he said that to me until we saw the full ramifications of it. And I will grant you that our taxes, which would be considerably higher had that not passed, are lower, but our schools are suffering. We have phone-a-thons all the time, to even in Lake Oswego. That's how they're paying for teachers. Those consequences weren't what people saw when they saw that ballot measure. I think any time that we can have the opportunity to let people honestly vote on what it is that the measure is intended to do, then that's a good thing.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the fact that the outcomes or the processes could be both of equal concern. But I want to tell you, most of the folks that around here who express angst over the initiative process don't like the outcomes. And I agree that there are some unintended consequences, or at least consequences that cannot be known. Trust me, no legislator in this process and no fiscal analyst in this process could have reasonably predicted all of the outcomes of Measure 5. But we'd also have to admit to ourselves that a good number of citizens are enjoying home ownership because Measure 5 kept taxes lower, and that they would be out of control, and that we'd have serious ramifications for homeowners if we hadn't Measure 5 or some iteration of Measure 5. I'm stuck with the idea that since people don't like the outcome, they want to change the process. And the code for that is, well, we want people to understand better. And I guess the limiting factor is you can only understand what there is to understand at the time. And the best you can do is what the analysts will give you. And they are not prognosticators, and there's no crystal ball. And often in future iterations or as time goes by, a small difference or a small declension creates a big change in what was intended as to what's actually delivered. That's why we revisit these issues periodically. But I'm stuck with the theory that the initiative process was a mechanism by which citizens get an opportunity to address or redress issues, address issues and redress grievances. And to insert the legislature into that process seems to me to be to subvert the process because we don't like the outcomes.
May I respond?
Yes.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, I think that's unfair to say that it's just about the outcomes. The process itself has been so corrupted from the original intent. I myself find it really unfortunate that we don't have all volunteer signature gatherings if this is really a citizen process. That's not legal, unfortunately, to prohibit people from being hired to collect signatures. So as long as we have a situation where it has become a business, then we need to look at how that business is run, especially when the business is crafting laws for the entire state. So I think I will agree with you that people do not like the outcomes, and that would be part of the motivation for some folks, but the process itself is not in good shape.
May I respond?
Yes.
I have to agree with Andy's analysis. I don't think the outcomes are the whole ruling factor here. And if you go back to history and remember why we had it in the first place, why we got it in the first place, is because the legislature and judges and people were co-opting the citizens' issues and were not responding to the needs of the citizens. And so in a very circumventive way, they managed to get the ballot measure so they could vote on doing something about it. But I think that as Senator Morris points out, that one of the outcomes that I think we are concerned about is that 50% of the general fund revenue now is cast in stone, if you will, and it has to go to certain things, which leaves not a lot of money to do all the rest of the things. There's one other comment I'd like to make in response to the clerk's problems with 656. There is in the House, and it's House Bill 3240, which is going to be heard this afternoon, which would ask that the state also get involved with funding elections at the county level to help with the costs of elections, because the counties bear the burden now unless it's a special election from the state. And if the state moves to help with some of those expenses, that could be an answer to a longer ballot for the counties.
I hesitate to prolong this, but Senator Farioli and I sometimes disagree and sometimes we agree, just like all the members of the committee here. I'm going to cite an example that could be used by both sides, because you could say that had this been in effect, the legislature would have been forced to do something, although Senator Farioli could say the legislature would not have needed this in order to do something. If my memory is correct, Measure 5 was the fifth reiteration of a property tax limitation measure. Each time a measure came close to passage, the legislature came back into session, continued to cut school funding, which actually continued to raise property taxes, and ultimately, after five attempts, the measure finally passed. I don't say that because I wanted it to pass, but it actually passed. But the legislature failed to address the underlying issue, and ultimately, the counties that I represent were largely the determiners that the Measure 5 actually passed.
Sure.
So, I mean, you can make a case on both sides that had this existed, the legislature would not have been able to delay or would not have been able to put the issue to the side. They would have had to debate the issue of rising property taxes and a different way to fund some programs. You could also make the case that even without the law, the legislature could or should have done that.
Mr. Chairman, could I make a statement about integrity here?
Yes.
I understand that there's a solution being aimed at here. Very often when the legislature will refer an issue to the people, it's designed to be preemptive. It's designed to split the vote and prevent the passage of an initiative. And I know you both know that. And I know folks in this building are well aware of that. It's one of the more despicable things that I think the legislature engages in. An initiative comes up, it looks like it has legs, the legislature looks at it, perhaps the majority party gets excited because of the unintended or unacceptable consequences, and so the politics are arranged to refer a vote that'll split the vote, and if that action takes place as designed, it'll prevent the passage of either, because neither will get critical mass. I want you to remember, these are the people that you are asking to engage in the process because you feel citizens are currently co-opted.
Well,
Chair Devlin, if
yes.
I may, one more thing. There is another bill coming over from the House that I affectionately refer to as Indirect Light. It's sponsored by Representative Witt, and I would like you to take a look at that bill as well. It allows for a legislative committee that is split evenly between the major parties to review the initiative before it goes to the signature gathering phase, in other words, after it's just qualified. And at that time, the chief petitioner may accept the changes that have been made by the legislative council. So we're looking at better product. And I think that would address some of your concerns about the politics.
I have allowed some latitude in this in referring to other measures, largely because both hearings are open and largely because this committee, although I think if Senator Burdick was added back here and I multiply the times, there's probably 60 years of discussion of initiative-related issues on this committee. But I wanted to get the committee to get they all know what the issues are. They're all going to be exposed to them. Just knowing what's happening out there, we've been discussing ethics for a long time. And so we're trying to move on from ethics, so I very much appreciate you both being here today.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you for your tolerance of my wayward testimony.
Yeah, but keep at it, please.
I just did the math. It's 60 years. Nice job, Mr. Chair. Pretty quick math.
I apologize to the parties that have been waiting so long, but if you'd like to come up forward, Ms. Bartlett and Mr. Meek, and again, I appreciate your patience, and Ms. Bartlett, since you signed up first, if you'd like to start off, and then Mr. Meek, and that will conclude our testimony here for today.
My name is Alice, Mr. Chair, my name is Alice Bartelt. I'm public policy co-chair of American Association of University Women, and we too are members of the coalition, the Initiative Reform Coalition. I don't want to belabor my testimony. It's very similar to what the people before me have said. I do think the main thing that we are concerned about is the fact that many of our ballot measures have in fact impacted the financing of schools and other important government services, and we support both education and human services, and every time that we have an initiative or a ballot measure that forces us to spend money in other areas, it's difficult for the legislature. So we are not against, certainly, initiatives. I think initiatives are wonderful in many cases, but it's also an issue of where the money ends up coming from eventually, and if, in fact, there is money to pay for it. And that's all that I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Mr. Meek.
Thank you. My name is Dan Meek. I've been involved in the initiative process in Oregon for about 31 years, since 1978, and I've represented many groups that use the initiative process or that support and oppose measures. First, on Senate Joint Resolution 11, which I oppose, You've heard that there's an indirect initiative in several states, but there's nothing like this. What this does is it simply imposes a 19.5-month delay between certification of sufficient signatures and the vote of the people on that measure for every single measure. That is, instead of having a 4-month campaign between the time you have your signatures verified, you now have a 23.5-month campaign after you have your signatures verified. I think this will be a huge strain, particularly on any grassroots organizations that are capable now of navigating the increasingly complex and costly system of initiatives in Oregon. Andy Miller mentioned that the initiatives have become a business in Oregon. That's because of the enormous complications that have been imposed on the process by the Secretary of State and by this legislature. Back in the 1980s, grassroots organizations were able to put measures on the ballot at a cost of about $20,000 with the help of volunteers. Today, the average cost of putting a measure on the ballot is $400,000. It's more than a factor of 20 higher. And that isn't because it has nothing to do with the proponents of the measure. It has to do with the new restrictions imposed by the Secretary of State and by this legislature over the years. So when you say, oh, the initiative process has become a business, and then you say, let's make it even more complex, let's make it even more difficult for people to put measures on the ballot and more difficult for them to get passed, that to me seems irrational. Since it takes a year to 2 years at least to draft a measure and collect the signatures, particularly since the ballot title process imposes an indeterminate delay in the middle of that that can itself now is frequently 7 or 8 months. This bill would cause the time period from the time that you draft and submit your prospective petition to actually getting it on the ballot to be just about a minimum of 4 years. It seems to me that that's way too much time to require petitioners to go through. This would also not improve the drafting of any measure because the bill does not provide that during any of this process of legislative review, the chief petitioners can amend what they originally filed 3 years ago. In other states with indirect initiative, as is pointed out in a report, a very large report by the Center for Governmental Studies at UCLA, what they recommend for California is that if you go to any kind of an indirect initiative process, that the chief petitioner should be allowed to amend their initiative based upon what is learned in the legislative review. But SJR 11 would not allow that. What it would allow, however, is the legislature itself to place in the voter's pamphlet a statement of unlimited length, which I believe would inevitably be contrary to and urge a no vote on the measure. The entire point of the initiative process is to present to voters ideas and measures that the legislature will not adopt. My primary interest has been in campaign finance reform. The Oregon citizens on a statewide basis have 4 times voted for limits on political campaign contributions. The legislature has never done that. In fact, the only thing the legislature has done is repealed those limits on one occasion. So I think the statements by the legislature that are going to be put in the voter's pamphlet under this measure would be inevitably negative, and I don't see why opponents should have to overcome an unlimited statement of that will be inevitably negative in addition to what would be in the voter's pamphlet already. If this kind of a delay, kind of a minimum 3-year delay in having an idea considered by voters who are the legislators in the initiative process is a good idea, perhaps it should be applied to the legislative process itself. That is, after any bill is introduced in the legislative process, perhaps you should require a minimum of a 36-month delay before it can be enacted. That would be that's the equivalent of what this is proposing. In addition, as has been pointed out here today, the legislature can already perform the review function on ideas that are proposed in any event. For example, on campaign finance reform, there are bills on campaign finance reform in every legislative session. There's talk about it in every legislative session. But what I'm after is not talk about it. I'm after actually getting it accomplished. In the last initiative cycle, 7 of the 8 initiatives had already qualified for the ballot before the special session of 2008. So if this legislature is going to be taking up annual sessions, it could easily review those measures in the current schedule without imposing an additional 19.5-month delay on every measure. In addition, 7 of the 8 measures that voters put on the ballot in 2008 were already on the streets with very serious signature gathering efforts before even the 2007 regular legislative session began. So if the legislature would wish to review those are available for review as well. So I think I think what this measure would do is simply make it far more difficult for anyone to propose a measure to ballot, a measure to voters that could possibly be enacted. In addition, now it costs 20 times more to get a measure on the ballot, even if you try to use volunteers. It's because many of the petition signatures that are filled out by volunteers at circulators now are rejected because of the hyper-technical requirements that volunteers aren't aware of. But what this would do then is change a four-month campaign basically into a 23-and-a-half-month campaign, a two-year campaign for anyone who wished to get a measure on the ballot. You'll note that a lot of the rationale for this seems to be that ballot measures have fiscal impact. But you will note that this measure, SJR 11, applies to every ballot measure, even if it has zero fiscal impact. So I would suggest an amendment that if this is to go forward, that it should apply to those measures that have a significant fiscal impact and not to every single measure. In addition, it's been stated, well, all that we're doing here, all that you would be doing here, is sending this measure to voters to vote on it. But if this legislature follows the precedent of the 2007 legislature, then you all would be writing the ballot title for this Senate joint resolution. And as you've already heard in testimony, what the ballot title says is quite determinative in elections. It's extremely influential. This legislature wrote seven of its own, referred seven measures to the voters in the 2007 session, wrote all seven of the ballot titles. Not only wrote the ballot titles, the caption, the yes-no question, the summary, also wrote the explanatory statement. That is, it eliminated the explanatory statement process. Of course, it eliminated the ballot title process for referrals, which under statute go to the Attorney General and are subject to public review and judicial review. All of that was eliminated. The legislature also wrote the fiscal impact statements, which also bypassed the fiscal impact statement process. As a result of those seven measures, six of them passed, most of them overwhelmingly. The only one that didn't pass was the tobacco tax, which was opposed by an expenditure of, I think, $15 to $20 million. So this legislature has actually taken not this one, but the last one in 2007, took it upon itself to refer measures to the ballot and then to a huge degree, control the information that voters saw about it by writing their own ballot titles instead of using the objective process that is provided for, where at least the Attorney General drafts the ballot title to begin with, and it's subject to some judicial review. So I think merely offering to voters a Senate joint resolution in this case is not a panacea. It's not, oh, well, it's just up to the voters to decide this. We're only promoting democracy by sending this to voters. I would say that in that case, the legislature should not write its own ballot title for this measure. Various proponents have said that what this will do is give measure proponents a platform in the legislature. First of all, having that platform is not worth a 19-and-a-half-month mandatory delay, number one. And number two, in the case of the measures that I've been working on, there is a platform every session in the legislature. As I mentioned, every session the legislature discusses in one form or another campaign finance reform, although the legislature has never enacted limits on campaign finance reform. Andy Miller stated that polling suggests that people want the initiative process to be improved. There was, however, just last month, a Riley poll which rejected the notion of legislative review of measures, particularly when compared to citizen review panels, which is another bill that is being discussed in the House. As far as the Initiative Reform Coalition goes, I haven't been invited or even notified of any meetings of the coalition. I'm not aware that there is a single active user of the initiative process in that coalition. The Taxpayers Association is not invited. The medical marijuana folks are not invited. Healthcare for All is not invited. So I think what you've heard so far is simply testimony from folks who wish to make the initiative process more difficult, to make it more expensive, and to basically close it down. And for progressive measures, I'll tell you what basically is closed down. In the year 2000, there were nine measures on the ballot that I think any objective observer would say are progressive measures. By the year 2008, that number had dropped to zero. And that's because it had become so difficult and so hyper-technical to engage in collecting the signatures. By the way, Senator Atkinson was correct to have a concern about the period of time for collecting signatures. Under the original draft of SJR 17, by the way, that would have totally abolished the initiative process for the 2012 election cycle, because it would have moved up the deadline for submitting signatures to 2 weeks after the measure would have been enacted in, this measure would have been enacted in November of 2010, assuming that's the ballot it would be placed on. The amendment, the proposed amendment to it, restores the initiative for a cycle for the 2012 initiative cycle, but then it truncates the period of time for collecting signatures in the 2014 cycle from what is now 2 years to a period of 4.5 months. So you're correct to have a concern about that. And I would like to make a couple of brief comments about the other bill, Senate Bill 656. I think that bill will actually, instead of providing more information to voters, would provide misinformation to voters and incorrect information to voters. It requires that you put right in the caption, and that's what voters read, that 15-word caption, to put right next to the caption the various statements about fiscal impact. Number one, it doesn't distinguish between negative and positive fiscal impact. Even if a bill, a proposed measure, would be a revenue positive for the state, the indication in the caption would still be fiscal impact with no identified source of funding. Doesn't make sense, but that's what it requires. Number two, it dramatically emphasizes cost, even if cost is a minor or infinitesimal part of a measure. For example, the Measure 47, the campaign finance reform limits. The fiscal impact statement, fiscal impact committee, on the basis of a single letter from the Secretary of State, concluded that that would cost about $1 million in the first year and less than $100,000 in every succeeding year. Under this bill, it would state fiscal impact with no identified source of funding. Of course, if we identified a source of funding, it would say fiscal impact with identified source of funding. Nevertheless, it would say fiscal impact, which would emphasize that aspect of the measure, even though it would have had an effect on the state budget equal to, even in the first year, of 0.04%. So if you want to put it something about fiscal impact in the caption, simply saying fiscal impact, I think, is misleading to voters. I think it should say what the fiscal impact is and put it in context of the state budget. If something is going to cost 5% of the state budget, put that in there. But if it's going to cost 0.04% of the state budget, put that in there instead of listing those in the caption with exactly the same words. There were amendments to SB 656, which I believe would make the initial proposal even worse. First of all, it would require these fiscal impact statements in the caption with no threshold whatsoever. Even if the financial impact of a measure is $1, it would require the fiscal impact statement in the caption has fiscal impact, which again I think would actually increase the amount of distortion and misinformation provided to voters. Number two, it would require a legend such as measure does not provide a plan for funding, or measure provides a plan for partial funding, or measure provides a plan for full funding. Well, when the measure is drafted, how do the measure drafters know how much is required for partial funding or full funding? Because the fiscal impact folks don't look at a measure until after it's qualified for the ballot. So you're expecting the proponents of the measure to anticipate, you know, a year or a year and a half in advance or more, what the fiscal impact folks will think is the fiscal impact in order to provide for, let's say, full funding in the measure itself. So I think this, it just doesn't work. The time sequence doesn't work. Representative Galizo said this does not require initiative sponsors to do anything, but yes, it does. It requires them to anticipate what a group of government officials will think is the fiscal impact and somehow provide a plan for that a full year and a half before that fiscal impact is identified. In any event, I think these kinds of statements in the caption, which are nonspecific, which lump together measures which spend a lot of money, all together with measures which have nothing to do with spending money and would spend an infinitesimal amount or nearly zero, I think that would be a disservice to voters and would be far more misleading than informative. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes.
I do have one. Mr. Meek, thank you for your testimony. Just because of your expertise on this, I want to ask you a question, and not to debate the merits of it, because there would be other issues that would arise, but under the current constitutional provision, couldn't at least a hybrid of what this, I'm talking about SGR 11 now, is intended to do, couldn't it be possibly done now under the current constitution? And what I'm referring to is the language in the Constitution says all elections on initiative and referendum measures shall be held at the regular general elections unless otherwise ordered by the Legislative Assembly. So again, I don't want to debate the merits of what this might do, but under the current law, couldn't the Legislative Assembly say all initiatives will appear on the May ballot of, for example, this year, which in which case they would be turned in 4 months before, under the current constitutional law, 4 months before the election. So they would be turned in almost exactly the same week that this body would be coming into session. And so they would then have those a couple of months, at least, before the deadlines for ballot printing, et cetera, to accomplish that same thing, should they so wish, without actually having to change the Constitution. And again, I don't want to talk the merits of that, but wouldn't that this idea be able to be implemented that way?
Yes. Senator Metzger.
Thank you.
Appreciate everyone here that has testified. And Mr. Meek, I just wanted to talk to you about one statement that you made and to see if you would clarify that statement. When you referred to the legislature overturning campaign finance reform, if my memory is correct, that's the 94 measure that was effective for the 96 cycle that the Supreme Court overturned, and we actually ultimately did change one of the provisions in it after the Supreme Court overturned it, which I affectionately called after the Supreme Court took away the contribution limits, that you could contribute to a candidate that didn't need the money and get the tax credit.
Chair Devlin, actually I was referring to the action of the 1973 legislature.
Oh, 70. Oh, okay.
Which repealed the limits that had been enacted by voters in 1908.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that information. Appreciate that. Again, if either of these two bills come back to this committee, the chair will ensure that they have an additional public hearings before they go into any work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Excellent public hearing. You're quite welcome.
That we are going to be, committee, we're going to be meeting Tuesday at 5, I believe, and next Friday, depending upon whether or not we have a session, the time will be determined, and the following week we'll be only meeting on Friday.